Accession number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 21. Now, anything else you want to raise about your time in Aden? Because you were there from March 65 to November 66, so a year and a half-ish.
There was one particular week. I think I've mentioned Mombasa to you. Have I going down there or not? When I took my motorbike down and...
Yes, you did.
Yeah, fine. With Kilimanjaro, which was a splendid thing after some duty down in Eastleigh. But one of the other things that I must say, because it was important for after the Air Force as well as during, and that was the 50th anniversary of 43 Squadron, which we flew on the 15th of April 1966 with 18 aircraft. I think there were 16 from the wing. Well, that's wrong. All 18 were from the wing, but 16 Mark 9s, probably with... maybe 1-7, I honestly can't remember the trainer. I think probably not. I think they were all 9s. And the last two, in other words, 16 FGA-9s and two FR-10s from memory, just as to celebrate that 50th anniversary. And originally, I was... and that was probably earlier on, I did not... even though I think it would have been a good idea for the Army and that, I did not continue my low-level aerobatics there on the Hunter. Although I probably would have liked to keep the skills up. And to some extent, I did try and keep the skills up a little there in different ways. But the other thing that occurred was almost three incidents quite rapidly happened together almost in the same week by pure coincidence, and the two important ones were being hit, and I think I mentioned that to you about doing a flag wave. I can't remember where that was on the tape, was it?
Well, you were talking about the flag wave, yeah.
Yeah, well, if I spoke about the flag wave, that's right, but in the same week, literally a couple of days later, and this was just before I went away on leave, I was taking off probably round about noon and went from Camaxa. It was on the narrow neck of an isthmus, and you went straight out to sea, you know, as soon as you'd got your, even before your wheels were up, you were over the water, and I was just climbing away normally, and probably... it might have been at least 2 minutes later in the climb. I was slowly, very slowly aware that the fire warning light had been on. And that sounds ludicrous in a way, because normally anywhere else apart from the Middle East, you'd pick a fire light up straight away because it's bright and it's right at your, almost at eye level on the right, and you pick it up pretty quickly. But it was it had to be a slow awareness because it was dull and there was a lot of sun on it. And to start with, I didn't think it was on. And then I realised it was on. And not only did I realise it was on, but that it had been on some time. And that affected my my drills, really, and my reaction to it. Plus the fact that lots of people, I say lots, that's wrong, but there had been... several incidences of people jumping out of Hunters that were not on fire with the loss of the aircraft. And I just carried out the normal drill of throttling back completely to see if the firelight went out. And then partly in my mind, because it had been on so long, I was quite happy to wait longer than the normal 10 seconds, I think it was, and then you were supposed to stopcock. But after a considerable, well, not a considerable time, I should think probably only 10 or 15 seconds, it did go out. But I'm pretty certain it did go out. But in fact, I was still on fire, but without knowing it. And my RT was not working too well. I was just getting intermittent calls to the tower, and in fact they may even have seen, as I climbed away, without being able to tell me, that I was on fire. But to cut a long story short, there's a very long runway at Kamaxa, even though it's very warm, and obviously your landing run was longer for that reason. But I did not carry out the normal drill because I turned straight away downwind, and though, although I'd be landing...
Now, what would the normal drill have been?
Well, if the firelight hadn't gone out, one would have stopcocked, and probably at that level, with the position I was in, I probably would have... you normally eject. But as I say, there'd been ejections before, and there'd been no fire there. But I turned downwind, and downwind at Kamaxa, in other words, preparing for my landing, was right over Sheikh Othman. And if I'd carried out the normal drill of dropping off the two 30-gallon tanks, there could well have been a lot of people killed down there. And, of course, it would have been, you know, international news because it was the worst place for dissident activity. Sheikh Othman was worse than Aden itself on that front. So there's no way I was going to drop my drop tanks. Because it wasn't necessary. I was in manual, but again, that did not matter because, again, there was a long runway there, and with 3,000 yards, there was no real problem. And I just stopcocked, I think, when I turned off the runway and put the bang seat safe and climbed out the back way where you can actually... do, and vacated the aircraft, and the fire trucks, I think, were already there then. And the point of it was I actually was on fire. And then it was very easy for people afterwards
aircraft,
to look at...
Not you.
The aircraft, sorry, yeah. And that was S Sierra from memory. I didn't mention that we were talking about the RAF Museum between us, but the FGA-9 that's there... we flew out in Aden, and it's got the joint markings, 43 and 8 Squadron, the split markings, which I haven't mentioned before, because we shared with 8 Squadron not only the 24 hours on, 24 hours off duty style arrangement, the split FGA-9 responsibility between us, but we actually shared the markings, 8 and 43, on either side of the roundel, as you can see in the RAF Museum. Now, and then I went on leave, and really all the point of what I'm saying is I felt quite strongly on, you know, when you've got the degree of experience I had that, and that did happen in other incidents where if you followed the pilot's notes too religiously, you would end up with strange outcomes. And there was no problem about landing there at all, but I think pretty certain the boss or somewhere higher than him looked at the pilot's notes and said, why didn't he drop his drop tanks and all that lot? And by which time I was on leave, and I never saw this. And I just thought, you know, that often the last person to see things after the senior officer's comments go on them should be the pilot involved. And far from being thanked for saving part of Her Majesty's property, the high value item of the Hunter, because obviously they learned from the problem, and they still had the aircraft. And also, at that time, it was close to when I picked up the enemy action business on the flag wave. Now, something I didn't mention was the 50th anniversary of 43, when we had that flypast. And
no, you did. You mentioned.
I did. Yeah, but what I didn't mention was the fact that we, about six or eight of us, went back to UK for the 50th anniversary of the squadron reunion in London, which was a rather splendid event with a lot of Royal Flying Corps guys there. Lord Douglas was there, Lord Balfour, and people, well-known 43 people from World War II, like Peter Peter Townsend and Frank Carey and Jim Hallows, some of the top people in the squadron's history. And to get there, I had to hitchhike back because some airman, sadly, had put a jack through a Comet wing. And because of that, my flight back was not secured. And for some reason, I had to get back by hook or by crook. And it was just as well in a way I did, because it was a really splendid event. But I picked up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I spoke to a captain and crew just coming through with a Super Constellation with some horses. Well, they'd taken some high-value horses out to to Tehran, and were on their way back through Aden just refueling. And this Super Constellation, I mean, it was really oily on the outside, and it looked pretty dangerous, but they agreed to take me through. And I should never really have gone on board, because the only way I could get back to UK was for them to stage through Cairo West. And that's the point of the story, in a way, because I had to, there was some freight there, and literally the whole fuselage was absolutely filthy all the way down with the horse manure, and I think they'd taken some cattle there as well. But they agreed for my security and safety, being through Cairo West, because there was no way I wanted to be found there. They walled me into a kind of tall sort of toilet facility there. Well, I think it didn't have the toilet, and I can't really remember that, but it was very narrow. And it had a window that one could open. And to my great surprise and slight horror, as we were landing and taxiing round at Cairo West, I saw literally hundreds of Yak 25s and MiG 15s and MiG 17s and the Beagles, and literally hundreds. And of course, that was whatever it was, 18 months or so ahead of the Israeli war, and you could see what an incredible amount of aircraft there were there. But I really felt I'm for the high jump if when the people come on board to inspect, twig what's going on. But fortunately, there was no problem at all, and because I'd been walled in with all this freight, nobody found me there. And I got back to the reunion, and it was marvellous meeting these people. And all I'm saying, telling that story, was that you know, how impressed I was with the strong history that 43 Squadron had got, largely because of this guy Jimmy Beadle. And it was his book on 43 Squadron that was slightly affected later events. And also I got to know him quite well, and I've been on the, as a committee member now for whatever it is, it must be 36 years, about 36, 37 years on 43 Squadron's committee. That's the Fighting Cocks Association. And it was that historical element between the two Tangmere squadrons, 43 and 1 Squadron, that I was about to join, that really got me interested in aviation history. The last thing I'll mention was just for a pure statistical point of view. There were 21 operational sorties I was involved in out in Aden, and only 21, and almost too many of those were the Bay Han patrols. The other ones were obviously far more interesting, where you actually went in and had to attack people to save our forces, or take targets out that were causing problems. My very last trip out there, well, sorry, on the statistical side, I noticed using the 3 out of 4 sortie, firing sortie method. In other words, because of the inaccuracies of our rockets on occasion, going wild, and also harmonization and things like that. Quite a good comparison is to just take everybody's scores over a long period of time and just count three out of four or four out of five because of the giving an even playing field for firing in any weather and at any time, etc. And I noticed it was 54% for the air to ground and just over 10 yards, 10 and a half yards on the rockets on that front.
This is in practice?
Yes, and we did an academic sorties and operational attacks, but that was surprisingly, you could have some quite strong winds there, and of course the RP using the firing on the RP targets for the 3-inch rockets, there were quite a few that would go twirlers or strange, and that they were very, as you know, they were World War II designed largely, the 60-pound head rockets that we were using. And just the last thing to end on a high note out there, my last sortie was to lead six people or six aircraft, and that was the 12th of November. I did my final trip, and that was six target strikes, so it was a kind of multi-strike simulated to strike six targets one after the other and then do a 4-versus-2. And I'm just saying that to demonstrate the versatility and the length of the sortie, because compared with the early Hunter 1, the 9 had double the amount of...
Now, this is practice.
Yes, yeah, but you did practice simulated strikes from there, and likewise back in UK, so that really, in many ways, you could... the practice was pretty good with the cameras, you know, the camera gun. You could work out from the camera gun whether you'd be hitting targets and what the range were and all that lot. And it's a remarkably good simulation of the real thing. But we did get plenty of experience of using the operational rounds and the SAP heads out in Aden and also back in UK. And you're right to emphasize the difference between academic and operational firing. And there was a mix of doing the academic where you could pick your pick when you fired. In other words, you'd have 10 minutes on range or whatever it was to pick the targets you actually fired on. But we did do, and later and elsewhere, straight in operational attacks where you went in and had to fire on your very first approach. So November I come back to UK. We did some splash firing out in Aden, which I haven't mentioned, but I don't think it's too much about that. That's with HMS Stryker with the Navy towed targets. And coming back to one squadron, yeah.
Now, tell me about this. So this was going to be your final posting, as things turned out.
As things, yes.
Now yeah. So you got back in December after leave. Now, what were you being posted to?
Well, I think Wing Commander Martin Chandler out there had tried to get me a flight, but obviously there were only, I think, three in the Middle East, if you counted 208. And most of that was organised from UK, but I was posted as a flight commander back on number one squadron. And in those days, not that much was known about the squadron history, particularly of one squadron. It was sort of underwritten about. And of course, it was effectively, you know, the oldest military squadron in the world, but there was only one little book, quite a, you know, about sort of 15 less than 20 pages, I think, and a half sort of A5 size book, almost leaflety size, that I was given, which was suspended when I got on the One Squadron, but it had a very distinguished history, going right back, as I say, to the balloon days as number one airship company from the Air Battalion, formed in May 1912 with the Royal Flying Corps, as you know, one of the first four squadrons. The role there was...
Now, it says you were part of 38 Group NATO. What's that, NATO Mobile Squadron?
What does it mean? What was really extremely good, and it's been written about how important it was in many ways, and I've no idea how it evolved, but everyone said it was a very successful and pleasant and sensible thing to do from a tactical viewpoint, both from the people in it and for its usefulness. But the concept was we were actually in Transport Command, which was later Air Support Command, but it was still Transport Command when I joined, and we were part of number 38 Group Transport Command that was linked effectively with the support in terms of hunters and the transport support in terms of argosies and interlinked transport forces for rapid deployment around the world.
So were you to defend these?
Yes, but it was partly the other way around, that the transport also would work in, go out with us to deliver us in places. But the easiest way to look on it is probably to say that the kind of five fingers in our role, or the five localities, that, apart from UK, because one mustn't forget the marvellous range, in a way, that we had from UK on our sorties. Almost every sortie was a mix, because the nine had such long legs, and that was just using the 230s without the 100 tanks on either the 200 outboards. We didn't like flying with the 200 outboards because it was a bit of a cow in a way, but it was quite all right for ferry work, which was where they came into their own. You know, you could fly down to Malta all right, and from Malta it was fairly straightforward down to El Adam. The range of the Hunter 9, I never ever got 3 hours out of it, but on several occasions...
What's 3 hours?
I meant 3 hours of flying. It was normally... I think the most I ever put in my book was 2 hours 55, and that was... And once out of Gibraltar, 2 hours 50. But that was actual flying time, because I always underestimated normally when I put things in my logbook, as I explained to you, because of the balance factor, that you ended up getting more real flying yourself if you did that, compared with others on the squadron that sometimes, and elsewhere in the Air Force, sometimes rounded up. I've mentioned to some extent the UK area, where there were 20 to 25 different exercises that we get involved in.
Now, you were based at West Raynham.
West Raynham, yes. I arrived there just before Christmas, and I had to go on a course for, well, two voluntary courses. I think one was to do with Russia, which was quite interesting, and I forget what the other one was now that I went on, but it was really a kind of holding for about 3 or 4 weeks before turned up with One Squadron, and that was at Christmas and just after, because I can remember the first day I flew, or the second day I flew, Peter Curtin was one of the first tour blokes. He might have been an ex-QFI, actually, or no, maybe went off to that later, but no, I think it was his first tour, and he ended up not quite making, after engine problems, an airfield, and having to bang out. And the actual unbelievable coincidence that occurred was the Hunter 9, that One Squadron Hunter 9 that he was in, actually crashed into a house, and amazingly, the person involved was, it was kind of a vicarage place where the actual reverend was literally in his, on his toilet in his bathroom when when his house was rearranged. And also he was linked as a kind of stand-in padre or honorary padre of where Peter was trying to get into, which I'm pretty certain from memory was Leckenfield, just on the outskirts of Leckenfield. So it was a bit of drama on the second day. I can remember flying, and that was before the New Year day. And but then I was very lucky, really. I had a lot of flying there, partly because the new boss, who I knew from Aden, squadron leader Spike Jones, who'd been out on 20 squadron when I was on 26, and then on down at Gütersloh later, when we met each other. Well, he hadn't been at Oldenburg, I'm wrong, but he was on 20 squadron later, which was at Gütersloh, on the same wing. And the other flight commander was Andy Whitson, but both of them had slight problems with back and some medical problems, with particularly the boss with his bad back, and had problems. So it worked out quite well that I was able to get a lot of flying, and in a way I had to probably do more flying than maybe was good for me. In a way, I had 370 hours flying over those 15 or so months. Great deployments, and going back to the five overseas bases that we tended to have involvements with, starting from the top, there was Norway, and that was largely winter training, and the exercises were often called something like, the first year, I know it was Exercise Cold Winter, which is frequently used, but it was really so that we could redeploy and reinforce the northern flank of NATO away up at the top of Norway. And we'd probably stage out, as I did the first time, through Riga, and then from Riga up to Andøya, which was way up beyond the Arctic Circle, beyond Bodø, and not quite as high up as Tromsø. And to this day, the Harriers are doing that similar role, in a way, for the winter side. And then going the other way, there was a reinforcement of because ACE, which we mentioned, was the Allied forces in Central Europe that our link was with NATO. And we'd reinforce Germany on exercise at least once a year, to go into some of the German airfields. Plus, we would do operational attacks on Nordhorn, which were great value.
On where?
Nordhorn, which was one of the ranges fairly close to the approach. We'd fly out towards the Frisian Islands, and often with bounce aircraft to attack us on the way, and then we'd let down and track in on a southerly heading down towards Nordhorn. And to start with, we'd be going along the lots of flat country that, when it was flooded, which often would be quite difficult to navigate, because the maps all of a sudden, if you had loads of rain and floods, the rivers that were marked would be all over the place a wee bit, but that would be operationally coming in for a one pass attack for your rockets, and then going round for your fixed gun attacks normally.